Adrian Day, CEO of Adrian Day Asset Management and manager of Euro Pacific Gold Fund. Thanks for joining me. Welcome to The Competent Investor.
Well, Tom, it's great to see you again. I'm glad to be here and look forward.
So, Adrian, you just returned from PDAC, obviously, a really big mining conference that kind of maybe sets the tone for a lot of the miners for the rest of the year. What were some of the things that maybe surprised you about PDAC this year, and how would you gauge sentiment within the mining industry right now?
Well, the sentiment at the show was definitely very, very positive at the beginning of the show. I think it had gone among the investors. I think it had declined a little bit by the end as you know, gold didn't respond the way people expected to the bombing in Iran. A lot of the companies, I have to say, the junior companies were almost exuberant. You know, people would say, oh, you know, I've had five major companies come by today to ask me about my projects. Yeah, okay, that's what you would expect, isn't it? That doesn't mean they're going to buy you tomorrow morning. So I think there was a little, I mean, I think there was a little over-optimism on the part of the juniors. You know, it's not surprising the senior companies are looking. That's not surprising. But generally speaking, it was obviously a pretty upbeat conference. Yeah. But I think the sentiment is interesting. I mean, we can talk about why gold has declined since the bombing. I think that would be interesting to talk about. And maybe we should talk about that now, should we? Because that leads into sentiment.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, it seems like gold moves ahead of these types of events, right? So why do you think that is?
Well, no, you're absolutely correct, first of all. And, you know, I did a brief study going back 50 years to actually the oil crisis back in 1974-5. And that, of course, takes in the very first Iran hostage, Iran problem when, you know, the Ayatollahs first came to power, and then we had the hostage taking. And you know, it would be very, very difficult for anyone to look at that table of all the geopolitical events of the last 50 years, we're talking negative geopolitical events of the last 50 years, and show any particular correlation with gold, particularly on the upside. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right, that gold tends to move up ahead of these events, and then it tends to drop in the immediate aftermath, you know, aftermath of 1, 2, 3, 6 weeks. And then what happens next, you know, depends on other factors. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I mean, very rarely does something come just completely out of the blue. You might argue that the Iran hostage taking was completely out of the blue. 9/11 was completely out of the blue. But most things, there's some kind of, you know, they build up, there's rumors, there's discussions. Certainly that's the case with the Iran bombing. That shouldn't have come as a surprise. The surprise was they did it in the middle of the day. But I don't think there was any surprise that it happened. Similarly with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, you know, you could argue, I don't think they're going to do it. I do think they're going to do it. But it wasn't a complete shock to everybody, but tanks and troops were massing on the borders. And as the tanks and troops were massing on the borders, gold moved up. And within a week of the tanks crossing over the border, gold hit a peak. And again, within, 6 weeks, it was back to where it was 6 weeks ahead. And we've seen the same thing here. You know, gold was up $500. People forget it was up $500 in 8 days ahead of a bombing. And now, of course, it's taken most of that back. Not all of it, incidentally, but most of it. So why is that? Well, I think partly it's by the rumor sell the news. That would be one thing. I think the other thing that people miss is, you know, if you're a gold investor, you think about gold. You say, well, gold's a safe haven asset. So when this happens, gold should go up. But there's other things going on at the same time. And it was very, very clear with Iran that that within 24 hours on Monday afternoon, the dollar started moving up. And as the dollar started moving up, gold dropped. So, and in fact, the action of gold for the last 2 weeks has been pretty much, if it parallels anything, it's an inverse of the dollar. Interest rates moved up. So that's the second thing. That's competition for gold. So dollar up, interest rates up, suddenly gold is less attractive as an investment. The other thing that happens, of course, is in any of these geopolitical events, you tend to have some kind of liquidity crunch. Maybe not global. We did in 9/11 have a global one, but certainly regional. And we've certainly seen that with Iran, where gold stored in Dubai and other Emirate countries is actually being dumped at discounts and meaningful discounts. People, you know, when they started bombing Dubai, people started selling their gold aggressively. People who want to get out of a country and have to pay a premium for a flight or whatever, they will sell their gold. And you know, we've discussed this before. I remember discussing it in 2008. Gold is the ultimate source of liquidity. It's something that can be sold anywhere in the world 24 hours a day. So if you want to sell your gold, you can sell it. And it's the ultimate source of liquidity. So in a liquidity crunch, gold gets sold. So I think all of those factors play into it. And then, of course, they build on themselves. The people who were buying gold say, oh, maybe I'll wait till the war settled down. People who only just recently bought either panic and get out or stop losses or whatever. To me, honestly, Tom, and I'll end on this. To me, honestly, the surprise, if anything, is just how little gold has declined. It's been, that doesn't mean we won't get more. It's closing as we speak, just a tad above 5,000. But to me, it's been remarkably resilient when you think how far it's come in the last, you know, few months.
Well, Adrian, when we couple that, let's say gold's resilience here, or as you also kind of put it, the lack of response to the war, if we couple that with how oil has also moved, the price of oil, and maybe even the price of the US stock markets, do you feel like the market's ability to actually respond to these market events is a little bit more muted now?
The ability, I'm not sure if the ability is. I'd like to hear if you have sort of thoughts on that. I certainly, if we look at the stock market, I certainly think that the stock market is being awfully, awfully complacent. Awfully complacent. And people sometimes say to me, oh, you think the stock market should be down? You think this, you think that. No, I'm not making a prediction on what I think is going to happen. I'm just saying that there's a risk that X happens. There's also the possibility that Y happens, and the market is not responding to X at all, right? Now, you would expect in this situation stocks to be weaker than they are, especially since this happened after months of the stock market going nowhere anyway, right? So you would have expected a bigger response. Oil's interesting because obviously the oil price has moved up. But the oil stocks, I don't think the oil stocks were exceptionally cheap, undervalued, I should say, going into this. You know, if you look back, say, 3 months with gold at $60 and you look at the valuations of the gold stocks, I think the oil stocks, I think the oil stocks were already moving up. And they were already discounting at least partially higher prices. And again, with the speculation, I mean, that was for other reasons. That was because they were just pretty attractive. They were paying dividends. They were buying back stock. They weren't actually investing in their business, but in the short term, the oil stocks were looking pretty attractive with their dividends. And then, of course, when the speculation about the war came, they just moved up even further. And so the day the bomb started, I don't think they were particularly cheap, frankly. And we've been selling our oil stocks. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag, but certainly the stock market is being very complacent. And I think that comes back largely to the fact that so much of the money going into the stock market, the US stock market now, is 401k. So people sign up for a 401k and the money comes out every week or every paycheck. The company matches it and it goes into the stock market.
In
And
other
if you're
words,
in a
that
401k plan, you don't say, oh gosh, this week I want to buy oil. Oh my gosh, let's sell the oil and buy gold. You say what you want at the beginning of the year. And for most people, they put it into the S&P. So that money just keeps on going into the S&P.
that passive indexing that automatically happens.
Yeah. Well, most of that money is passive. Of course, you can. Some firms will offer you, some programs will offer an active management, but most of it is just passive. And it's very, unless you're in a really big firm or a very innovative firm, most of it is either US big cap or US value, global, bonds, or cash. Well, which of those do you want? They don't offer gold. They don't offer resource. They don't offer emerging markets. Most of them I'm talking about now. So most people just stick it in the S&P.
Adrian, it's interesting that you mentioned this disconnect between, let's say, the more global or spot gold price and the Dubai gold price at the time. I saw another, let's say, disconnect in pricing that oil in Dubai right now is selling for, I think I saw it this morning, it was like $149 a barrel versus the crude oil in the US price being around 90. So, are these dislocations in prices like that, or those discrepancies in oil in different locations, similar to when we saw these dislocations in, let's say, London versus Shanghai gold?
Yeah, no, I think they're different. I think the difference this time is they're caused by very, very specific factors. Again, you're in Dubai and the Fairmont's being bombed. Well, are they going to bomb my gold storage bank next time? So let's just get rid of the gold. I don't want to take the risk. And similarly, if the oil's simply not available, you're going to pay a premium to get it if you need it. So I think it's a little bit different from what we saw in London and Dubai and in London and Shanghai with the gold market. And of course, I think the gold price will settle down fairly soon. The oil, as most of us people who want to sell at a discount, sell at a discount and go and leave. But the oil price obviously will be dependent upon, the situation on the ground. I mean, if they just can't get if the oil The actual oil supply is in shortage, then you're going to have to pay a premium.
So let's tie this back into what you were saying earlier about sentiment, Adrian. I've heard you also say that you're very, very bullish on gold for the next 6 to 12 months. So what do you think, let's say, precipitates or catalyzes that next move in gold? Is it more of these geopolitical events? Is it institutional capital? Is it retail investors? What do you think is the driver?
Yeah, I think the war has probably, pushed that back a little bit. No, I don't think it's more geopolitical events. On the contrary, I think when the war calms down, whether it ends or it, I don't know, gets into some kind of stalemate or it just calms down in some way or another, then I think the monetary factors that have been driving gold for the last 2 or 3 years will come to take precedence again. And, the factors that drove gold for the last 2 or 3 years are still in place. We still have inflation that's stubborn in the US and Europe and around the world. We still have fiscal deficits that are out of control in most of the major economies of the world, and certainly in the US are just continuing to deteriorate, with no, where it seems like no willingness to try to tackle the problem. They're just getting worse. And a perfect example of that is a Department of Education that Trump said he was going to abolish. And when he introduced the woman, what was her name? DeVos. What's her name? Is it Betsy? I forget now. Sorry.
That sounds familiar, Betsy DeVos,
But
yeah.
when he introduced her, he said, your job is to do yourself out of a job. Great. 1 year later, what do they, less than a year, what, 1 year later, what do? They increase the department's budget. Well, we're going in the wrong direction, folks. If we want to abolish it, we're going in the wrong direction by increasing the budget. And you know how it works. I mean, it's the way it works in Washington, and it's worked ever since I've observed. Basically, I want to spend money on welfare, and I want to spend money on this bridge in my constituency. Tell you what, I'll support you if you support me. Which means everybody's pet project gets funded. They don't say, well, let's have a compromise. Cut yours back and I'll just forget about my bridge. No, the opposite. So anyway, all of the fundamental factors are still there, and the drivers of gold, the central banks, obviously the momentum is going to slow as over the last quarter century. The percentage of dollars in global central bank reserves has declined from about 78% to about 48%. So the momentum will slow. And when they sell dollars right now for the last 5 years, most of that is going into gold, right? Very little into silver, very little into, surprisingly little into the euro. I mean, surprisingly little on the one hand, but not on the other hand. If your concern is concentration in a single asset, so you're reducing the dollar, but you're also concerned with the fiscal irresponsibility, and you're concerned with the government's willingness to weaponize their dominance, well, do you really want to go into euro? Because the euro colluded with the US in the confiscation of Russian assets. And I'm not arguing whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but we know what the consequence of that was. And so I asked the question many times, if you've now got 48% of your assets in the dollar, down from 75 or whatever, and you're concerned about those three things, right? The concentration of a fiscally irresponsible government that weaponizes dominance, and you're continuing to earn dollars, fresh dollars, well, you're going to continue to sell, aren't you? Because 48% is still too high. If you're worried about those things. So I think that demand is still there. Tether is a huge new demand for gold. As you know, last year Tether bought more gold than any central bank did. I mean, it's astonishing when you just stop and think about it. We say these things sometimes and move on, but just think about it. Tether, something, an organization that, to be honest with you, Tom, I'd never even heard of 2 years ago. And they now are buying more gold than any central bank in the world. Unless something really dramatic happens there, that buying is going to continue. And the interesting thing about both central banks and Tether is their buying is largely, or to a large extent, is price agnostic. They buy, particularly with Tether, they buy when they sell the, bless you. They buy when they sell the gold stablecoin, and they need the gold to back it. They don't, and the central bank doesn't say, you know what, we've earned a lot of dollars in the last quarter, but you know what, let's just wait. Maybe on Friday, on the witching hour, gold will be down a bit, and we can buy some. No, they buy when they want to and need to. So I think that buying is going to continue, and then on top of that. It's interesting to note the individual investor, the non-specialist, the generalist investor in the US is simply not in this market. You only have to look at the flows for the GDXJ and the GDX and the GDXJ. GDX, other than 2 weeks at the beginning of February, interestingly enough. Well, at the beginning of February, it's been almost consistent selling.
Adrian, it's interesting the way that you mentioned, let's say, the Department of Education not, let's say that promise not coming true. And we can also look back to Trump's promises about being the president of peace and not starting any new wars. Should we extend that, let's say, skepticism of reinvesting in the US and bringing manufacturing back, possibly bringing, accelerating mining, making sure that we are securing domestic supply for many of these critical metals and minerals? Do you extend that framework and that taco mindset into this reinvigoration?
Well, I obviously don't want to get too political. I don't think that's what people want from me. I am extremely skeptical about not just this administration, but all administrations, all congressmen, all Congress, all congresses, I should say. Very, very skeptical. No, but I think for one of the good things, no, I think one of the good things that this administration has done, and it would appear is carrying out and will probably likely continue to carry out, is that acceleration of mining permits for fast tracking of projects, whether or not we get the critical, the supplies, the stockpiles of critical minerals. Whether or not we get refineries like lithium, for example, it's not a shortage of lithium, it's a shortage of refining. Well, that's true of some of many of the rare earths indeed, but they're not so rare, but we don't have any way to process them. Whether or not all of this comes to fruition or not, I don't know. But there's no question when you speak to many, I mean, I've spoken to many CEOs of companies, exploration companies, and companies in development across the US, and they all say things have got, on a practical basis, on the ground, they've got dramatically easier in the last year and a bit. You may have seen today, was it today, I think, or was it last night, that the government's made an agreement with BHP and Rio on the Resolution, big copper mine in Arizona. It's just been sort of stuck for years and years and years because apparently there's a sacred mountain nearby. But in my cynical, I'm a very cynical person, in my cynical way, I'd say the sacred mountain didn't appear so sacred until suddenly they discovered copper. But anyway, that's me being cynical. But now they've done a land swap, and it looks like that may go ahead as well. So no, I think they're definitely moving. I think they're definitely advancing in that area.
So what do you think that means for the mining sector as a whole, Adrian? It seems like we have increased M&A within the sector, and one would think that as this cycle continues, and if gold prices keep moving up, that is just another sign of that market evolving.
I mean, look, you can have the will, but that doesn't necessarily mean every rare earth project or uranium, project is actually going to come to fruition. They just simply may not be economic at the end of the day. They may not be large enough at the end of the day. But at least we're moving forward on that. It's interesting. There's definitely a pickup in M&A among the senior companies, and I'm talking maybe, the top 10, and particularly the top four or five. There has been and continues to be, I think, to a large extent, a willingness to pay more than you could have got a project for, but to make sure that it's wrapped and got a nice bow around it, meaning permitting's done, the social license is done, the drilling is done, we've got a resource estimate, and so on and so forth. And I think the larger companies are willing to pay up in order to get a more finished product. and you've a product project, and you've seen that over and over and over again. And that's particularly true when it's a project that everybody says, oh my gosh, Agnico simply has to buy that. It's right next door to their mill, or Newmont obviously has to buy that. Well, if you have to buy it, you can afford to be a little more patient. That could be shifting, I think. I mean, we've seen a couple of things like Great Bear, of course, which didn't even have a resource estimate when it was acquired. And but that astonished everybody by the fact that it was an outlier, right? You don't expect that from a major company. I think the fact that Agnico did not buy Foran's project, and forgive me, I can't remember the name of the project. If you said it, I'd say, oh yeah, that's it. But which was a project that, everybody said, oh, Agnico's going to buy that. Agnico's going to buy that. And then Eldorado came in with a pretty good offer, which Agnico's not willing to pay above. When you top someone's offer, you not only have to, make your offer meaningfully more, but you also have to pay off. You also have to account for any cancellation, penalty fees if the deal's cancelled. And so Agnico's just decided that's too expensive for them at this point. I think that might make people say, you know what, if we really want something, maybe we should be prepared to buy it, earlier rather than risk missing out. Because let's face it, Tom, there's only so many good projects around, right? They're not a dime a dozen. Things change, of course. Mexico's a little out of favor now. If Mexico comes back into favor, we could probably see a pickup in M&A down there. But there's only so many, good projects for senior companies that are around. And if a company wants one, I suspect you'll see a little bit of a shift in that attitude. But you're also going to see the mergers among, intermediate companies. And you're going to start to see more and more. The seniors are taking a different approach recently to have been taking a different approach recently to the exploration companies, and it varies company by company. But particularly Agnico, which has been buying stakes, 9.9% stakes in a whole bunch of companies, it gives them a seat at the table. It gives them, they watch, they get information. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to wind up acquiring a company, but they seem more prepared to do that kind of thing just to get a seat at the table and watch something and watch how it develops. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. But again, at the real junior end, I mean, there's only so many good projects, and I think people have a misguided or overly optimistic view of just how many of these projects are going to be bought in what period of time.
Adrian, as we've seen the metals prices move up, obviously we've seen massive margin expansion as well. So how important is that to consider when you own a stock and the metals price goes up and their margins just continue to expand? Does that make a company continue to be attractive even despite it having a 2 or 3x appreciation?
No, absolutely. No, and that's an excellent point. If you take a static snapshot of where we are right now, right, with everything, then Agnico Eagle, for example, and this applies to many of the others. Well, I'll give an example about Agnico, but it applies to many of them. They are actually fundamentally better value today than they were 2, 3 years ago. And so you look at Agnico and you look at its price to free cash flow, which would be my favorite metric for a gold mining company, right? Price to free cash flow. It's higher today than it was a year ago, but it is lower than it was for each of the 5 years prior to that. And on a 40-year basis, it is very close to its all time, it's in the bottom 10th percentile much closer to the low than even to the average, let alone the high. So the valuations have simply, for the reasons you said, the valuations simply have not kept up with the increase in the gold price and the increase in the stock price. And that, of course, is because up until fairly recently, we had costs. Everybody goes on and on and on about costs, but the truth is the costs have been relatively under control. You look at Agnico, they just reported costs, all-in sustaining costs, not cash cost, all-in sustaining costs for last year. I think it was 1,379. Someone correct me if I'm wrong, but it was in that range. And they sort of said, well, it's above our estimate because with the higher price of gold, we have to pay more out on royalties. And that goes into their all-in sustaining costs, which is a bit of an irony. As the price of gold goes up, your costs go up. Anyway, but so I mean, that's astonishing when you think the price of gold is 5,000 and their all-in sustaining costs are less than 1,400. They could accept the price of oil, which is about every $10 on the oil price has about a 2% increase in gold mining. I'm not talking about Agnico specifically, but gold miner costs. So gold going from 60 to 100, let's say it stays at 100, we're talking an 8 or 9% increase in costs, right? I mean, if your costs are under 1400, a 9% increase, yeah, that's something. But compared with $5,000 gold, it doesn't destroy the value, I guess is what I'm saying.
I just looked it up, Adrian, and for 2025 it was between 1313 and 1340, and their guidance for this year 26 is about 1475. So
Yeah.
you're spot on, and even if we do see that, about $100 per ounce increase, obviously, the price of oil plays into that heavily, but that's a massive, massive margin.
Sure. And it's worth pointing out that some of the companies, and again, to give a real example, and we're focusing on Agnico as our example. They have actually hedged forward over 50%. Over 50% of their diesel, their energy, is hedged forward for 2026. And it's hedged at something like $2 a liter. I mean, it's hedged at a very low price. So, yeah. Now, one thing we always have to be careful of with cyclical businesses, not just gold, but any kind of cyclical business. Sometimes the valuations, like the PEs and so on, can be very deceptive at tops and bottoms. When you think about it, if you have a sharp drop in the price of a product, your stock is going to collapse at the bottom, right? And if your stock price collapses, you may find that your price earnings has actually gone down. And that would be a trap to think that at that point it's low. So you have to be aware of that. And that's why I started by saying if you just take a snapshot, the stocks are cheaper today than they were before. But again, as we've said, they can tolerate higher costs. They can tolerate a lower gold price. If gold goes back to 4,000 and oil stays at 1,000, they are still making very, very attractive money. Not just not as attractive as they are now. Now, there's no question that if the gold price drops to 4,000, the gold stocks are going to drop. There's no question about that. But similarly, I would say if the gold price goes to 6,000 and 7,000 and 8,000 over the next few years, these gold stocks are going to continue to move up.
So, Adrian, obviously, we've talked a lot about gold. What is your outlook on silver, and is that as attractive to you as gold miners are, or are they harder and more volatile to understand?
Yeah, well, on silver first, I'm less convinced on silver than less of a conviction on silver than I have on gold. I am bullish on silver, don't get me wrong. I am bullish on silver, and the odds are that both of them will move up at the same time in different degrees, but then both move up at the same time. But I would say that I think gold probably has better risk reward. So the potential for silver may be just as strong or even better, but I think gold has better risk profile. On the stocks, as you know, there are so few pure silver companies around, whether they're miners or exploration companies, and all of them are mixed hybrids to some degree or another. I think some of it is a reality and some of it is just a perception. Pan American Silver, for example, which is a company I like. I don't want people to think I don't like it, but it's a company I like. But they've got silver in its name. So people think they're a silver company. And of course, it's the second largest publicly traded, they produce the second largest amount of silver of any publicly traded company. But last year, before the MAG acquisition, that silver represented 22% of their revenue. So is that a silver company? Then you look at someone like a Cisco, or royalties, over 35%, closer to 40, I think, in silver. Look at Wheaton. Until that last deal that they just did, that huge deal that they just did, Wheaton was over 40% revenue from silver. It was one of the largest percentage of revenues from silver of any company out there. And yet I would venture to say that most silver investors, particularly those on Reddit and so on, when they want to buy a silver stock, they don't immediately say, oh, let's buy all royalties or Wheaton. I don't think so. So that's a prelude, if you like, to saying, I sort of don't really look at the silver stocks separately than the gold stocks. When I'm looking for a silver mine, when I'm looking for a silver stock, yes, I will look. If I think silver is going to be particularly strong, I will look long and hard. But the truth is, most of the times we're getting a bit of a hybrid. There are some silver stocks that I think are very undervalued right now. But I think, both exploration, more exploration than the producers, to be honest. But the
Right.
truth is, Tom, if I may say this, and this is not a knock on these companies, but when silver moves up and people buy silver stock, they look, oh, let's buy Coeur d'Alene, oh, let's buy Hecla, and those stocks, or let's buy First Majestic, and those stocks do respond. But in the cont but if those were gold stocks, not silver stocks, I ask the question, would they be at the top of your shopping list? Or are there other companies that are better companies? So I just prefer to focus on the company as a company rather than whether, most of their revenue is from silver or not.
So, Adrian, one of your sayings is that investment fads come and go, but value is never out of style. So, where else do you see value in today's market other than, gold and silver that we've touched on so heavily?
Well, two main areas. First of all, we're seeing a lot of value in other commodities, which have, even if they've gone up, they've lagged gold and silver over the last year or two. And that would be, well, even copper, which of course has been trading at all-time highs, even copper has meaningfully lagged gold and silver. And we know what the demand, well, sorry, we know the demand projections for copper, I think, are probably exaggerated, but the projections for supply, for production, are not. And the reason for that is it's the long lead time from even when you have a copper mine with its permits, the long lead time for a permitted mine to actually start producing, which is, maybe 5 years after you've got your permits, means that we have very, very high visibility on how much copper there is likely to be in 5 or 7 years. And the truth is, there simply will not be enough copper to meet all of the current demands for copper, which means the price will go up. Oil, until the bombing, I thought was remarkably undervalued. The stocks less so, but as we commented, but the oil very undervalued. So once the war is over and things settle down and people give up on that trade, I think that'll be a very good place to buy. But I think most of the commodities, agricultural commodities, are cheap. I think most of the other commodities are relatively inexpensive compared with gold and silver. And then you look at the broader stock market. As you know, up until last year, the global stock market was really led by literally a handful of big tech companies in the US, most of them in AI. And that's what really w led the global stock market over the last 15 years. You had a period of 15 years of US stock market outperforming the rest of the world. Last year, that switched. And these changes in dominance tend to be fairly long lasting. So I just mentioned the US was a leader for 15 years. Before that, the foreign markets outperformed the US for about 10 years. Before that, it was about 8 years that the US outperformed, and so on. So I think we're likely to see a continuation of foreign markets outperforming the US. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the US is going down or the foreign markets are going up. It just means that the relative performance, the foreign markets will outperform. And and we've seen that this year. We saw it last year when the World ex-US index basically doubled the performance of the S&P. We're seeing it this year when virtually all foreign markets are outperforming the S&P. I'm less keen on most of Europe right now, but I have to say I'm a bottom-up investor, not a top-down. And so we will look for opportunities sort of almost anywhere and everywhere. But as Warren Buffett said, I like to fish in a well-stocked pond. So well-stocked ponds are the British market. The UK market is remarkably undervalued right now. Up until last year, for 20 years, it had basically gone nowhere. And everybody says, oh, well, Britain's going to, hell in a handbasket, and Keir Starmer's useless, and they're letting in too many immigrants, and blah, 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 blah. And crime is out of control, and so on and so forth. And all of that may be true, but if you've got a company based in Britain that's an exporter, they're not really concerned with the valuation of the pound. The pound goes down, it actually helps them. And a recession in Britain doesn't really hurt them. Et cetera, et cetera. So really good companies at good valuations in Britain. We're seeing a lot of good valuation in Hong Kong. There is a big risk with China, of course. Good valuations in Brazil, for example. So we're seeing good valuations all over the place.
Adrian, in your opinion, does this environment for all of the commodities here, does that lead us to a very stagflationary environment for the next, foreseeable future? What is your timeline on that, let's say?
Well, chicken and egg. When you have a stagflationary environment, the commodities, ironically, or as some would think, not immediately intuitively, but commodities actually tend to be some of the best performers. So when you have a stagflationary environment, gold and oil are often the top performers, but also the rest of the commodity complex tends to outperform the major market indices. And when I was talking about global markets, I didn't say that the emerging markets are even more undervalued than the major markets. So yeah, absolutely. To me, we are definitely moving towards that stagflationary period. You could argue that we're already in a stagflation, but just how deep is that? The economy, in my view, is definitely slowing. People talk about a K-shaped economy where the bottom leg of that K is already in recession. I like the analogy that my friend Brent Johnson used, which is he said it's not a K shape, it's a little I with a long stem and a tiny little dot at the top. And I think that actually better sums it up. But there's no question that the lower 50% in terms of income and net worth are really struggling right now because prices have gone up far faster than have wages. And we forget that everybody talks about, oh, inflation's down to 2.5 or 3%. Wow, it's down from over 9%. Yes, but that's 3% on top of last year's 4%, on top of last year's 5%. So if you look at the last 5 years, you see, according to the government's own numbers, right? We're talking the government's own numbers. The consumer price index is up about 20, almost 25% in the last 5 years. Wages have not gone up that much. So even if you still have a job, you have fallen behind. But of course, a lot of the lower half have lost their job. They're now working two jobs. So they count as employed, but they're now working two jobs. One's at a restaurant as a waiter at night or a dishwasher, and one's driving an Uber during the day, or conversely, driving an Uber half the night. I see that all the time when I catch a late Uber. Oh, they're driving during the night. Yeah, well, I lost my job and I just gotta, make it up. Well, they count as employed. But definitely they are underemployed. And so people are struggling, I would say. And on the other side of it, we know that inflation is, I like to say, stubborn. It certainly hasn't run away as it did in the 70s. But it's higher than the Fed's own arbitrary target, 2% target. And so we're seeing both a slowing economy and stubborn inflation at the same time. And I think both of those are just going to get worse. Inflation is going to continue to pick up as the economy slows, and that's stagflation.
Well, and that's an interesting puzzle too, Adrian, because if we have, as Peter Schiff would put it, that wage price spiral, if wages really start responding, then prices will only continue to keep going up as well, right?
Yeah, we're certainly not seeing that yet, though, are we? I mean, wages have been, I don't know how long they can keep that way, but wages have not really been moving up, as rapidly as the shortage of workers would suggest. I mean, it's a real irony right now, but you've got a lot of people without jobs or losing their jobs, and yet a lot of places, restaurants, service industries, hotels, airlines are struggling to replace those people. And I'm not talking necessarily about the captain of the 747. We want him to have had some experience and be trained. But, whether it's a dishwasher, I know a restaurant across the road that was looking for a dishwasher for like four months. They couldn't find anyone to do it. And, I gently suggested that probably if they raise the wage they were offering, he said they just couldn't afford. They could not afford to. So it's a real problem for a lot of industries now, attracting the people at the right wage, but still making a profit for your business.
Well, it's interesting to try to understand how the, let's say, what the policy response is to many of these issues. So, of course, tomorrow is Fed Day. What are you considering from as a Fed response to current energy prices, market dynamics, as well as what you maybe see out of the new Fed chair coming?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things there. First of all, by the time listeners get this, they'll all know what happened tomorrow. So I'm not going to make any bold predictions, but I'm not expecting the Fed to do anything tomorrow. I'm not expecting them to cut or to raise. And the reason for that they give will just be with the war, there are so many temporary uncertainties and changes that it would be unwise to make a policy decision. But if you look back, if you look at the composition of the Fed, today's composition, and you look back to the minutes of the last meeting that were released, a majority of the Fed members are far more concerned about inflation than they are about recession right now. So I think people's optimism for, the Fed to just dramatically slash rates going forward, and particularly when Warsh comes in, I think are misguided, frankly, because Warsh although he's a chairman, he's only one of, is it nine? I forget now. Is it nine or 13? It's nine members of the Open Market Committee, isn't it? Again, someone will correct us. I have no. But he's only one of several. And of course, Trump's also got another appointee on now. So he's got two people. And there's others that are leaning dovish and others that are leaning, but the majority is still, I'll say, independent of Trump, especially now he's picked his next Fed chairman. The others don't have to sort of, pretend that they're dovish in order to try and get the job. Again, my cynicism coming out. So what I'm saying is that it's going to be a while before Trump is able to replace existing Fed people with his own nominees. They rotate in and out, and unless you get rid of one or two or they resign, it's going to be a while. And the majority of the Fed is still more concerned about inflation. Now that can change, of course, if the economy starts to slow dramatically. But at the moment, I think we're going to see on balance, I think we're going to see rate cuts this year. But I don't think it's going to be as dramatic as a dramatic shift that some people are expecting. But of course, that's all bullish for gold, even if it's slower than people expect. And the other thing that we are likely to see, of course, is QE. When Powell introduced his 40 billion a month, not QE, QE, remember? They went out of their way to say, this isn't QE. Got nothing to do with monetary policy. Well, I beg to differ. Your reasons may be something separate from monetary policy, but it has the same impact as whether the Fed's doing it for monetary reasons or for non-monetary reasons, it has the same impact on the economy. And I'd be very, 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 very surprised if they end that in April when they said they were going to, and we don't go above 40 billion a month. So I think we're going to see more of the not QE, QE. And as the economy deteriorates, we'll probably even see, our old friend helicopter money come back. I mean, the Trump tariff refunds were in effect helicopter money. But we're going to see more of that, I think.
Why do you say that the Trump tariff refunds were helicopter money?
Well, if you're refunding money directly to consumers, then that is the same as, the COVID refunds, the COVID distribution and the 2008 checks. I mean, look, the truth is, I wish the Fed would be more responsible in their monetary policy. But, and this might come as a surprise to some of my friends, but if they're going to be irresponsible, actually just distributing money to everybody is a fairer way, a better way of doing it for the economy than the traditional way of feeding it to the banks and letting the banks distribute it. Because, there's that effect. It was an Irish economist 200 years ago called Cotillion. And the Cotillion effect, Cotillion, yeah, no I, sorry, Cotillion effect, is basically refers to where money first goes from an event. You discover a gold mine, and so the workers of the mine get raises, the owners of the mine get a lot of money. Then they go out and spend it in the restaurants in the local area and they get the money. But as that money spreads through the economy, the effect is less and less and less. And so you're seeing the same effect with central banks, where they increase the money supply and push it to the money center banks, but then distribute it. And so it's that old argument between Wall Street and Main Street. And the Fed's policies, I will say this bluntly, the Fed is directly responsible for the huge increase in the wealth gap that we've had over the last 15 years. They are directly responsible because of the increase in the money and the way they've distributed. And here's the thing, Tom, when the money supply goes up a lot, just think about this, asset prices go up, but only let's say that only really affects 20% of the population, right? At the same time, prices go up, but that affects everyone. And so the person at the top end sees his prices go up. Oh dear, I've now got to pay $1,000 for my bottle of wine instead of 800. I'm really annoyed, right? But his assets have gone up. The person at the bottom end only gets to see prices going up, doesn't get the assets going up. And so that's why we've had this enormous, enormous increase in the wealth gap, directly because of Federal Reserve policies.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the, let's say, how money enters the economy or currency, to be more specific, and then how it ends up or who it ends up benefiting the most, right?
Right. And it obviously ends up benefiting the most, just of the Cotillon effect. It ends up affecting or benefiting most those that first get it, and then the secondary people, high-end restaurants in New York, they benefit. Ferrari dealers in New York, they benefit. And then slowly, the diner in, Montgomery, Alabama, by the time it reaches them, it has very little positive effect and only negative effect of higher prices.
So, Adrian, as we're kind of wrapping up here, where do you see things 10 years from now? What are some big shifts that your peers might disagree with you on? And we can, what is one that you think is going to be a big thing? Obviously, 10 years is.
Oh, why you didn't give me time to think about that. Oh, well, I think the gold market is going to continue to be very strong for many, many years. I don't know how many people disagree with that. We all know gold's cyclical, but also gold cycles tend to be long. We're definitely seeing, and people, gosh, something that will surprise people, or people will disagree with. I mean, we're definitely seeing a shift away from US dominance, monetary, economic, political, and even military, frankly. If the US went head to toe in an all-out war with China, who's going to win? It's not the laydown that it was 10 or 20 years ago. So, I think we're going to move. Unfortunately, we're going to move into what people call this bipolar world. While you have different spheres of influence, but whether that's going to be peaceful or not, I don't know. And I'm reminded, people talk about the dollar losing its reserve status, and there's an argument about that, and the people on the up, what I call the up one side. We're always saying, oh, that's not going to happen because China's capital markets are not deep enough, and their currency isn't free floating. And those are true. That's true. But for the US to lose its reserve status doesn't necessarily mean that one country has to replace it. It can be a group of countries. It can be a lot of things. And when you think there's two things that determine a reserve status or reflect reserve status, one is your currency in global central bank reserves. We've already talked about how in the last 25 years, that's gone from over 75% to under 50%. That is a really, when you think about it, that is a huge decline. For central banks that tend to be slow moving anyway, right? They're very slow moving. But B, they have been earning record amounts of dollar because of a trade deficit. So they continue to earn record amounts of dollars. But despite that, they've cut their exposure to the dollar. The other side of it, of course, is the dollar's usage in global trade. And again, at the beginning of this century, something probably higher than 75%. Something over 80% of global trade was conducted in the dollar. I honestly don't know what the number is now, but I'm going to guess it's around 65 or 70%. So that side of it is coming down. And I'll leave leave listeners with the final thought, which is, that quote, bit overused quote from Hemingway, right? How do you go bankrupt? Slowly at first and then suddenly. And I think within the next 10 years, there's a very, very high chance that in 10 years' time, the US will not be the dominant reserve currency anymore.
Well, I don't know how many people are going to disagree with you on that one, Adrian, but
Oh, okay.
that's okay. That's okay. I didn't give you time to think about it.
Well, here's a good prediction. In 10 years' time, the Rolling Stones will do another final farewell tour.
And tickets are going to be even more expensive.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not.
Well, Adrian, I always appreciate getting to dig, deep into these subjects with you. Of course, more from you is all available at adriandayassetmanagement.com, and I want to thank you very much for your time and your expertise today.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and good luck with your new ventures.
Thank you, sir.